recorded live.
What's up, everybody? This is Jeff Roney, and you're listening to Roney's Own Radio live on TalkShoe. And it's like we're doing a timeshare seminar because it's just the faithful few. But, hey, that's okay. So tonight we're going to be talking about the greatest director, in my opinion, that has ever directed a film. His name is Alfred Hitchcock. I guess when people read it, they thought we were talking about giving blood over the internet or something, but that's okay. We trudge forward because that's the kind of guy I am. So anyway, you can find the other wonderful things that we do produce at roneyzone.com. I'm not going to spell it. You should know how it's spelled by now. So you can find many, many, many different great episodes and great shows there, like Ear Giggles. Don't know what that is? Go there and find out. You can also listen to shows called Tatooine TV. Again, if you don't know what that is, go to roneyzone.com and check it out. You can also find the classic versions and the classic version 1.0 of Roney's Own Radio there at, strangely enough, roneyzone.com. And you can also find just many other wonderful things there for you to listen to, look at. And, I know, if you have nothing to do, sometimes those MySpace bulletins that you posted are answering questions about your shoe size and what kind of underwear you wear and all that kind of stuff. I know you're bored, so if you're really that bored, you can send us an email at, I know you guessed it, roneyzone@gmail.com. So I hope you catch the sarcasm. There's a little bit there because it's the three of us in this room talking about a very cool subject. Okay, so anyway, we have
Roney
a lot of...
Roney Zone can't be beat.
Yep. We have a lot of other cool shows, and if you want to know where they are and what they are, you can visit talk.roneyzone.com, and you might even read about them there. So we are going to be talking about a number of great directors, and this is the first show that we will be talking about a great film director. And his name is Sir Alfred Joseph Hitchcock. Did you guys know he was a sir, that he was given that title?
I didn't.
I don't recall having that memory.
Okay, I am joined by my lovely wife, Saweetie, in the chat. And my good friend, your buddy Bill, he's also my buddy Bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
I confess, sometimes I'm referred to as the man who knew too much. And I remember when we were just strangers on a train going north
northwest. Hey,
what, am I a bit psycho for you right now?
Oh, boy. All right, so Sir Alfred Joseph Hitchcock was born on August 13th. 1899, in the town of, and I'm sorry for my British friends,
and my
British enemies. He was born in Leytonstone, London, England. And he began his career in England. He applied for U.S. citizenship in 1956. He did a lot of great films in America, and he died in Bel Air in 1980, sadly enough. So we're going to be talking about his films, his themes, what makes them interesting, what makes us watch them over and over and over again tonight. So, Saweetie, we will start with you. Give me a couple of words. When someone says Alfred Hitchcock to you, what words come to your mind?
Well, let's see. If you're asking for a couple of words, single words, I would have to say intense, suspense, just brilliant.
Okay.
Hitchcock films were so well planned, so well done, and so many layers to them, not just what you saw on the you know, celluloid.
Okay. Let's Bill, go ahead. Give us
clever
words. Go ahead.
Clever, debonair, craftsman, wily, and birds.
Okay.
The damn birds.
Right. I think the words I come up with is macabre, witty, and intense. I would have to take one of Saweetie's words.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you really start to talk about Hitchcock films, I mean, there's always one film that kind of jumps to most people's mind, and it's Psycho, I think.
Right.
Is that the one film that comes to your mind, Bill?
The one?
That the one?
No. That's not the first one that comes to my mind. It's the one with the
Psycho?
Flying avians.
Oh, the
birds.
The birds.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, right. Hitchcock, yeah, I think Psycho is the one that most people would agree. And it's definitely not my favorite. I don't think I've ever seen it all the way through. It actually scares the living daylights out of me. But it is the first one that comes to mind because I think that's the most controversial of all his movies, even though he's done some other movies that were maybe equally scary or equally as suspenseful. And movies that I consider, and again, I've not seen the whole thing all the way through, but I know the story very well and I understand it and I've seen parts of it, and I don't think it was his best work, and yet that's still the first one that comes to my mind because of the controversy that surrounds that movie.
Okay, and you're
or surrounded it, really.
You're talking about Psycho, right?
Yes, I'm talking about Psycho.
Okay. Who or what introduced you to a Hitchcock film?
Are you talking to me?
Anybody. Bill first.
Hey, how you doing? I think it was Channel 13. I used to dig around back in the days when there wasn't much cable, if any at all. They'd show movies on the TV, movies from before. And I think the first one I discovered was it was at the very end of Strangers on the Train, right? And I was just watching, it's like, I always thought it was kind of weird, you know, that they'd have TV shows, movies in black and white. And then my babysitter, because I was a young lad at the time, came in and goes, "Oh, that's a famous guy. Those immortal words that forever burned Alfred Hitchcock's name into my head were, "Huh, that's a famous guy." And they started saying, the guy's like in all of his movies, and like they're supposed to be like really cool, but some of them are hard for me to understand. And I understand that looking back on my babysitter, but that was the first time I encountered an Alfred Hitchcock movie, and later on I would seek them out as being intriguing, interesting, and not necessarily filled with the same old people and situations I was seeing in, you know, the spinoffs for all the sitcoms.
What about you, Saweetie?
Well, the first Alfred Hitchcock movie I ever saw all the way through and really was able to sit through it and be okay with it was Northwest, and it was actually at my grandmother's house at either Thanksgiving or Christmas. We were all kind of, you know, sitting around digesting our wonderful dinner, and Grandma popped in the movie. She'd just gotten a VCR, and she popped in the movie, North by Northwest, and I absolutely fell in love with it, thought it was one of the greatest movies I'd ever seen. And but I was still leery of other Alfred Hitchcock movies because of movies like Psycho and The Birds. So it wasn't until I met my wonderful husband who introduced me to vertigo and rope and To Catch a Thief and The Man Who Knew Too Much, which completely opened a whole new world of Hitchcock to me.
I would say for me that, I mean, I was only because after Jaws, I love to watch suspenseful films, and especially I love to watch them to kind of break them down into parts to kind of see why they scared me and see what the big deal was. And so I remember watching Psycho and then reading about how, and I went to Universal Studios and they said that the blood in the shower sequence was actually chocolate syrup, and then it had the same consistency of blood, but it didn't look like blood, obviously, in a black and white film. So that's when I started really to kind of get intrigued with this guy, this Alfred Hitchcock guy, that would fool you into seeing certain things that you really didn't see. And so I became enamored with another director besides George Lucas. And so I started really kind of looking into what he was all about. And I remember at one point, was dating a girl, not as wonderful as my wife.
Obviously.
But anyway, we went to go see Vertigo at a theater in Costa Mesa. And I have never been so enthralled by a film as I was with Vertigo. I may have even seen that before on a VHS or something, but I was totally blown away, because at the point, it was like in the 80s, and they just had remastered a lot of his films, especially Vertigo. That was one of the ones that obviously they wanted to kind of highlight, and it's just it really kind of blew my mind. And I knew that this guy was something special. So that's how I was introduced to Hitchcock. And my mom read a lot of mystery novels, and so she enjoyed the occasional Hitchcock film now and then for the whole whodunit type of thing. But I would say Vertigo kind of surpasses Psycho in a lot of different ways, and we'll kind of talk about that in a little bit. But so Edie, if you could, you probably already have, but let's go ahead and kind of give maybe your top three, your top five Hitchcock films, and then briefly give a scene or why you really love the movie.
Okay, wow, you're going to limit me to just three or five, huh?
Right.
Okay, well, let's see. In no particular order, but probably my favorite one for sure is Rear Window.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it for the suspense, you know he killed his wife, you know he did, and the desperately trying to find the evidence to prove it and yet not get caught by the guy. The fact that, you know, Jimmy Stewart is sitting there helpless, and he's a sitting duck if and when, you know, the killer figures out who he is. I mean, it was just the whole movie had, you know, a little bit of a sense of humor in Thelma Ritter. She was very funny, very, very funny in that, and she had some great lines. The next one would have to be Vertigo, and I love the stories that unfold. You're convinced that, you know, Kim Novak's character is completely just crazy out of her mind, and then you start to realize, oh my God, she's play acting. She's not, and you kind of wonder if she isn't play acting at first, but then, you know, you realize she really is, and then you get to the real meat of the story and why she's play acting, and it just blows your mind. I mean, just that, and I think the scenery and just the whole film, the love story itself is just really intense. I really, really, really love To Catch a Thief. Mostly because I just love Cary Grant, but the movie itself is so well done, and you watch it the first time you watch it, and you can't imagine if he's not really, I mean, is he really truly the cat burglar and playing like he's not and trying to throw everybody off? Or is there really a cat burglar and who is it? And could it be Grace Kelly or is it, you know, somebody else and you don't have any idea who it is and they pull little switcheroos on you and you're like, how did they get that past me? You're so engrossed in what is going on that it's mind-boggling, but it's a great movie. Let's see. The Man Who Knew Too Much. Oh, my gosh. That one's also another very suspenseful, very intense, you know, heart palpitations. They've kidnapped, you know, Doris Day and Jimmy Stewart's little boy, and can they save him in time? You know, what's the whole reason why they do it? Who's involved? Again, the scenery going from place to place, and you know, Doris Day was really good, and there's little humorous things, but very little humorous things in that movie. Let's see. Oh, Rope. Rope is another one I absolutely love because the way it was shot was phenomenal, number one. And number two, the story, there's this, you want to, like, scream at these people and go, look inside the, you know, the cabinet thing, look in there, you know, just this twisted sick thing of knowing that they're in the room with the dead body and they don't even realize it, you know, and it's just, and then to watch Jimmy Stewart come to that realization and figure it out and just, completely unbelievable, very intense. So I'd say that probably rounds up my favorites, and I really like North by Northwest as well, and, even Family Plot was kind of fun, but those are probably my big favorite ones.
Okay. Bill.
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't seen quite as many of Big Al's movies here, but I'm a fan of that The Man Who Knew Too Much. In fact, I think there have been a number of different movies over the years that kind of take that story and redo it, even a comic one with Bill Murray. Strangers on a Train. I like the whole idea where they go, well, you know, what would if you were trying to get away with a murder, what would you do? Well, I don't know, just in theory. You know, I mean, the whole concept that, you know, you people throw something around as sort of a goof or a mental exercise, and then, oh, my gosh, stuff is happening. Oh, my God, betrayal, turn around. Oh, look, around the corner, who's that? I don't know. Oh, romance, kill father, don't kill the father. Oh, I know, I'll put this evidence, and it'll be so damn. You know, lots of twists and turns. I enjoy that. I want to say The Birds, but with the understanding that there's whole parts of the movie I haven't seen because I end up closing my eyes. Okay. Birds are scary, all right? But I like the fact that it can freak me out without doing the sort of stuff that the horror movies that my brother and my friends would want to watch when we were, like, in high school and junior high, which would just be all chainsaws and blood, right? Where really their shock value was in showing you things that made you want to throw up. Whereas what I got from Alfred's movies was that he could, sometimes I call him Joey Boy, but that was just back in the day, was that he could give you this suspense and he could suggest things in such a way that your mind fills in the blanks. Now, granted, he also did such a wonderful job of setting up scenes. His use of light, of empty space, I'm going to stop now.
How you doing, Dave? Good to see you there, sir. All right.
And Emily from Ohio.
Yes.
Went to bio.
Yes, she did. And I'm going to pick, let's see. I'll start with three, and I'll probably think of two more as I talk. But I'm going to start with The Trouble with Harry. And that had probably the first appearance by the Beeve. Beaver Cleaver was in that film. Shirley MacLaine was in that film. And the voice of Charlie.
John Forsythe.
Yes, Mr. Forsythe was in that film. And The Trouble with Harry. Supposedly, Hitchcock really hated to shoot on location, although he shot on incredible locations all around the world. But he really hated location shooting because he couldn't control the lights and all that. So they shot in New England, and then they had to recreate everything in interior in the set. And so it's kind of interesting stories about, the trees and the turning of the leaves and all that kind of stuff. But the story was about this dead body. And it struck me that this dead body was more exciting than any of the people who were alive lives. I mean, this dead guy, it was the focus of their life. They kept digging him up and all this kind of stuff. Hey, Mr. Boshian, how are you, sir? Okay.
I think he was trying to speak. He looks unmuted.
I think I am unmuted.
Excellent. Hello there, sir. How are you?
Just fine, thanks. Yourself?
Oh, we're doing great, doing great. Glad that you can join us this evening.
Great.
I'm glad I could make it.
Yes. I'm waxing poetic about Trouble with Harry, and then after I go through my list, we will turn to you if you would like to give your top 3 to 5 Hitchcock films.
I'll be here.
Okay. So, Trouble with Harry... stories about a dead body that they keep digging up because they need to find out information about him. And at one point they say, no, this isn't right. We have to put him back in the ground. And then they have to dig him up again. And it's just, it's an incredibly funny story. And I guess that's what kind of struck me is just the comedic nature of death and things that are supposed to be sad. He found the comedy of it. And Psycho is obviously another one I really think is an ingenious film because the monster is this little, emotionally injured son that takes care of this hotel. And, he's the monster. And yet no one even realizes he is the monster. He's just, that's Norman. That's just Norman. He lives up in that house, and I don't know, he takes care of the hotel, and that's all. And in the end we find, that actually he's killed a bunch of people and all this kind of stuff. So, Psycho. And then Frenzy. We'll just kind of round it out with 3. Frenzy was an incredible film for a lot of different reasons. I mean, if you want to start getting very technical about it, it was the first Hitchcock film that had nudity. And, all right. So, that had never been done before. There was always this kind of inference of nudity in other films, but not... and he really shone. So Frenzy was a very interesting film because it was done from a very English point of view. And but there was one scene in particular that still it disturbs me today because it's almost like it was a scene where the camera's coming up to this doorway. Up the stairs to this second floor apartment of this, it goes upstairs to this apartment. And so something's happening up there. And so this lady goes upstairs and then you're kind of waiting. You're waiting for something to happen, and it's just almost unnerving that you're
attention.
Just waiting, and all of a sudden, then you hear the scream, and it's just, you almost jump out of your seat because you know it's coming. You know something's going to happen. You just don't know when. And it was just incredible. So those are my top three, and you know, I kind of want to spread it out so that the other films can be discussed as well. But certainly I have more. So if there are any more, we can kind of toss out there. But if not, we can start to kind of discuss themes, because I want to geek out for a little while. So.
Well, I got a little bit of trivia for you about one of your favorite movies.
Okay.
There is a character, the sheriff, in that movie,
right.
Trouble with Harry, and it was played by an actor named Royal Dano.
Right.
Royal Dano has the distinct honor of being the voice of Abraham Lincoln in the Disney, both Walt Disney World and Disneyland, Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, and in the Hall of Presidents.
Oh, okay.
So I thought
Very
I'd throw
good.
That out there, especially because I figured you would appreciate that information.
That's true. And
I
did not know that.
A Disney Hitchcock tie-in.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Fabulous.
Okay. So I'm going to start kind of talking about a couple of themes and really kind of pulling from Hitchcock's past and his psyche, and then we'll kind of move into some wider themes, but I want to kind of toss these out first. One of the themes you see a lot in this film, especially Psycho, is what they call a God's eye view, which is the camera way up looking straight down on something. And the thought is that God is watching, and it's almost like he's kind of really disengaged from it, but he is watching. And obviously there's a lot of other directors that have used that type of, you know, the camera straight overhead with Spielberg and different things like that. But God's Eye View, I mean, it was definitely named a number of times with Hitchcock. I mean, probably one of the most famous ones was the when Martin Balsam was going up the stairs in the Psycho house, the sheriff, and the camera followed him up, and then it, you know, trucked up, and then it moved around, and it was looking straight down when Norman, as the mom, came out and killed him. And so, again, it was that type of thing. And I think what's interesting is there is this distrust of, you know, religion because of Hitchcock's past. He went to Jesuit school and all this kind of thing. So there was kind of a real leeriness of authority, of God, of cops. Whenever you see a policeman, especially in Psycho, he's very mysterious, with sunglasses on, very scary, poking his head in the window like, "Hey, what are you doing?" You know, it's like, I don't know what I'm scared of more, of Norman or that stupid cop, you know. But it's just that whole fear of authority and that kind of, you know, and the mother and that kind of a thing. So there's always that kind of that fear that was built up by authority figures of all kinds. So I just kind of wanted to start there. If anybody wants to comment on that, that's fine.
Yeah, yeah. You know, another effect that the God's eye view gives is it disassociates the viewer from the characters. I mean, I don't know about you, but normally if I'm watching a movie and there's two or three characters on screen having an interaction, I tend to, during different moments, identify more with one or the other during the conversations, you know, have empathy, have feelings for them, distrust, hate, you know, whatever.
Right, right.
But when you back off and give the God's eye view, you give, you know, both the illusion of the physical distance, but also I think it
it breaks that connection you have between them, so that you can be a little bit less less tied into them and be a little bit more objective about what's really going on, what's the big picture and what's the scene. And I think there's other times in the movies, and I can't put my finger on one, so I'll see if it can be backed up, that I think that sometimes Alfred does want to observe people and in their natural state without saying anything about them, without saying, here is a good man, here is a bad man. He says, let's pull back, and it's a man, and this is what they're doing. How does it look to the world, to nature? That's just one other aspect, I think, of the God's eye view, which could also be, how does God feel about any one of those particular characters in that scene when there's so many others going on at the same time?
Well, and I'm going to kind of toss out a couple of things. We can always kind of go back and whatever. This is really a free form here, okay? But I want to talk just kind of briefly about karma. There's really a strong sense of justice in Hitchcock's films. Very rarely does anybody get away with anything. In the end, they don't get caught. And I can only point to one entity that really doesn't get caught. I mean, does anybody kind of realize in one film where, the perpetrators, kind of stay free?
Isn't it Family Plot?
Well, possibly, yeah. But I was actually thinking about the Birds.
Ah.
But everyone else get caught. Norman ended up in jail. They all get their, reward, let's say. Okay. Another thing is...
Well, maybe that's because they're the ones to blame. The Birds aren't to blame. They're just reacting.
Well, and that's a very interesting point as well, and that's kind of like a story I'm writing. But anyway, the Birds are finally, they're... I mean, it's a great plot and a theme piece of a very docile animal, a bird. They really, it's kind of, it reminds me of old Bugs Bunny cartoon, a bunny, who's scared of a bunny, and then Bugs Bunny just freaks out and starts causing all a bunch of havoc. And then finally his worth, because he's wanted, is like, a lot more than any other animal. But it's just the fact of the bird was such a docile creature. But if they did turn on man, that'd be quite a... I mean, just think about it.
Well, I mean, they're just a bunch of feathered small dinosaurs. That's what birds are, I tell you what. They're scary.
Okay. But to kind of tie in with the God's eye view and kind of a lot of what we're talking about is the voyeuristic aspect of probably all of Hitchcock's films in one way or another. God is watching us. We love to watch each other. Just that whole aspect. I mean, Psycho was just a thesis on voyeurism and watching and being watched. And how do you react to that type of pressure, to being followed by the police, to be observed, to trying to hide something and not be found, but trying to be out in public? What was interesting about Norman is that he was right out in front of everybody, and yet he's committing these awful crimes, and no one ever caught him. Nobody until the end. But I'm just saying that it was just that whole idea of he wasn't hiding anything. He really wasn't. They always just assumed, based on what they heard, mother's having a bad day. Well, mother really hasn't had any kind of day for a long time, but so watching, being watched, also being fooled by what you think you see and what's really there. Anything else from anybody? Okay. All right. To kind of move forward in what we're talking about, too, is that what I love about Hitchcock is he was a director who not only directed a film, but he directed a film that directed the audience, which I think is something that not a lot of people really think about.
Go into that more.
Well, you had mentioned that it was, see, and I know my wife's going to kill me, but she's thousands of miles away because I'm in Florida, so she'd have to fly a plane to kill me. You know, there's these big musical films that just have these big wide vistas and Oklahoma and all these things, you know.
Oh, and Malcolm Busby things with the dancing in the water.
There you go. All that stuff. So, but Hitchcock, you know, would use a gorgeous backdrop, but he loved to get in close and show you close up something. You know, a telephone, you know, he would zoom in and show you a man's twitch on his eye. That was one of the famous shots. Oh my gosh, I forget the film. Anyway, somebody's going to kill me. I think it's Notorious. Oh, somebody's going to write in. Oh, and maybe they'll send me an email. That's fine.
Send
so anyway,
an email to Jeff at
yeah,
ronyzone@gmail.com.
He had this camera move, and he zoomed in on this guy's eye until it twitched. I mean, so that's what he was trying to, I think, get across, is that always look, always watch, always observe. Never, ever, ever take anything for granted, because there's always something interesting, even if it's, you know, what I call benign or boring or whatever. That's really was the beauty of Hitchcock. I mean, one of the scenes that I love in Rear Window was, you know, that housekeeper, you know, where she goes, those plants have moved down there. Someone has moved those plants. And they go, no, what do you mean? She goes, didn't you take a picture of his flowers a couple of months back? And then they match them up, and she goes, see? There has been something has been digging down there. And it's that. And it's so incredible to kind of even a film like Psycho, where, you know, it kind of zooms in on the money. It zooms in on different things that he is pulling you in different directions. And he's saying, don't worry about that over there. Look at this. I know you want to look at that, but I'm telling you, this is where I want you to look.
There's a knife. There's no knife. There's a knife. There's no knife. Where'd the knife go? Oh.
Right.
Where it went.
And, you know, I just, that's one thing that I think is kind of lost in today's films, is that just the craft, you know, it's a word that you mentioned, the craft of making a film. It's one thing to write a film. It's another thing, and it's obviously another thing to film a film that's in focus, and the lighting's right, and the actors say their lines, but it's a whole another thing to craft a film and to say, okay, everybody says their line's right, the lighting was right, but I want them to look here, and look, we need to shoot a shot there. Well, the actors aren't there. I don't care. I want to shoot a shot right there, so that's what they see and that's what they notice.
You know, and one of the things you could see in movies, you know, other ones, where they will waste imagery. They'll let you watch, you know, people in a car having a conversation and backgrounds going behind them, but they blur it out, or it's meaningless, or all it was, you know, one mountain or one bridge to remind you that they're in a certain city or something. They tend to use, you know, or they might even have three people having a conversation as they walk down the street past some stores, but you don't get to get a feeling of what's happening in the stores, why the stores are important, why anything that's being shown in the scene is important to advancing the story. But Hitchcock's movies, to me, had a scarcity of images, but I think he used them conservatively and tried to make sure that what he put on film had a purpose,
mm-hmm.
and it meant something to him, and he wasn't just gonna waste something in the car. Because like even in Rearview Mirror, you do get to see things happening behind the car,
right?
That matter. Whereas in others, it'd just be a throwaway, and it's just, oh, let's just use something to convey the fact that they were in one set, now they're going to another set.
What I don't know if you know is, one of the terms that is used in filmmaking is you make sure you get coverage, which means you overshoot in different angles so that if there's a problem with the way the scene is cut together, that you have enough coverage, meaning another angle, another view, so that you can fix an issue. Well, Hitchcock was so good that he shot the film when he did his storyboards, basically. He shot it in his head. So by the time he set the cameras up, he knew exactly what to shoot. He never had any extra shots. He only shot what he needed. And that's what was cut, and that's what was on the screen. That's unheard of. I mean,
that's the thing about being conservative and being purposeful.
And even in North by Northwest, there's a shot of a little kid in the diner in South Dakota. When one of the actors shot a gun, the kid plugged his ears right before the gun went off because he knew that it was going to happen. And Hitchcock left it in. There's another shot of a mic boom in the shot, and he left it in because he didn't shoot another shot. That was it. So it was really incredible to kind of see that type of intensity, because you don't see that much anymore. You see a lot of CGI, you see a lot of, a lot of flash and all that, but just the intense craft of a movie making, you don't see that much anymore.
I was going to say, ahead. With Hitchcock movies is that they would have translated well to the stage, because
yeah.
he was very concerned with the story. And yes, there were details and things that went on with it, but he really wasn't concerned with, the mundane.
Right.
And yet, some of it was, because it was, like you said, a simple telephone or, a view of what's going on behind the car, something like that. I mean, the bottom line is his movies could have easily translated well to stage, because they were set like plays. They conveyed what they needed to convey in as little time and as little information as possible.
And I think following up on what Sweetie said there, because that's very insightful, is, there's something to be said for his early days in film and theater, where, he started off working on silent films, doing titles and doing, second unit type things. So, silent films are... have to be the outgrowth of the stage, and many times, they'd actually have live musicians, to keep the stuff going and stuff. So I think that also could be why he did focus on the imagery. The dialogue was something extra now he could add into it, like we might someday add smell-o-vision. But,
okay.
I think his thoughts about stage, engaging the audience, I think, like you mentioned, and making them part of the whole deal, making them fill in the blanks, and imagery. I think there's something
right.
to be said for his time spent working in silent films.
Yes, and you know what, too? I think that's why his dialogue was so sharp. It was very witty, and it was very sharp. He gets right to the point, and... He in cases he doesn't waste anything on dialogue. He sometimes, it's just honestly, where there's no dialogue, that's sometimes some of the most intense scenes. For me, what I'm thinking of in particular is The Man Who Knew Too Much. When Dorothy is standing downstairs at the theater and knowing that something is about to happen, that somebody's going to be assassinated, not knowing exactly who, and looking up and finally seeing the killer, and all that's happening is she's down there crying. There's no dialogue happening. There's shots between, you know, the choir that's singing and the orchestra that's playing, the gentleman who's about to be assassinated, and then there's, you know, the shots of the killer, and then there's going back and forth to her, wringing her hands, trying desperately to figure out what's going, you know, what she's going to do, but you know exactly what's happening, and there's no words. For what, a good, right, like, solid 5-6 minutes? Nothing, mm-hmm. No dialogue. So, I mean, it's a big deal, but then, and then, you know, you flip back to the whole thing of what I was kind of talking about earlier with the snappy, quick dialogue is in Rear Window. You know, Jimmy Stewart says, you know, he killed the dog last night because the dog was scratched around the garden. You know why? Because he had something buried in that garden that the dog scented. And his detective friend says, well, what, like an old ham bone? And he comes back with, I don't know what pet name Thorwald had for his wife. Snappy dialogue, you know, really funny dog. It's a very, very, very macabre scene and the subject they're talking about, but he still has a way to just kind of snap it up and, you know, and I mean, even further is, you know, the housekeeper says, let's go down there and find out what's buried in that garden. And Grace Kelly comes back with, why not? I've always wanted to meet Mrs. Thorwald. You know, she's supposedly buried down there. You know, just funny, funny crack-up stuff, you know? And then just, you know, you get to the point and they'll say things and you're like, where are they going with this? And all of a sudden they flip stuff around and you're like, oh, my gosh, I wouldn't have even bothered that.
I was upside down now.
Yeah, so. No, I mean, it's just there's always fun, you know, fun stuff to be had in his dialogue. But it does, it in some cases, and especially for me, I think Rope and Rear Window particularly feel like plays. Whereas, you know, North by Northwest is very, very much a movie. To Catch a Thief is a movie. Vertigo was a movie, although it could have easily been a play, too. I mean, there's ways you can, you can put it on the stage. So it was kind of it was a really good blend of that, you know?
Well, what I think was really, and I may be overstating it, but I am going to say this, is that I don't know if people do as much reading as they used to.
I'd assume that they don't.
A lot of Hitchcock's greatest films is, you know, he would say, I read a great book, you know, a great French author's book named blah, 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 you know, and that gave me an idea for this film. And then he would kind of build on that. And what I really love about his films is he obviously comes from things from a very English point of view, in that, for instance, in Rope, when the body was in the box, is that that's where they would, in older England, they would have like a hot box where they keep the meal. And so it was just this kind of this twist, funny turn of, you know, the most important part of, you know, an event was in the box. And yet, you know, nobody was looking in the box, but that's where the important thing was. And so it was always this kind of different layer, and not even just from the focal point of the room, but it was also this kind of a funny little English, British thing. So people from different cultures could see kind of funny little things as well. And it was kind of an inside joke, if you will. But
funny things and lots of layers. His films are kind of like an artichoke.
Right. Or like an onion. Okay. I think another thing, too, is he loved experiments. And I'm also going to throw in the word deprivation, and let me put them together. Is the whole thing about Rope was, you know, basically, how can I shoot a film with the longest shots as possible? And I mean, that almost sounds like a college exam or a college, you know, film student project. You know, shoot a video with the longest shots possible without a cut. You can use black, but you cannot cut the film. And I think it's a, you know, I mean, it's just that alone would be very difficult. But then to pull it off and have pull away walls and cameras rolling around, because cameras in those days were not small. They were huge.
Right.
And so, you know, opening up the doors and rolling them through and making sure all the lights work and on a constant basis and all this kind of stuff. So,
well, you know, and to do that, you know, with the dollies and the size of them and the crew it took, I mean, it's almost like running your own miniature railroad, you know, to get the track down and make sure they're not in the way of everything. I mean, which probably helped that, you know, when he went to college, you know, he did focus on engineering.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe he got to apply some of that. And, you know, it's funny that he did that with rope, whereas, you know, knowing the story, I would have expected that, gosh, you know, that should have been something kind of easy to kind of do for the majority of Lifeboat. But
mm-hmm.
I think it was more challenging.
Well, and that's another movie. That's another deprivation idea. Let's shoot a film on a lifeboat in the middle of the ocean. Well,
mm-hmm.
How interesting is that? Well, let's find out.
I'm getting seasick just thinking about it.
See? or say, let's do a film without any music. And that's what he did with the birds. Or let's do a film with just string and orchestration. Psycho. So there were all these things where they were experiments, but they were also experiments in deprivation. He would pull things that normally people relied on. And he would just say, "No, I don't need it. I'm gonna do it without it." And you know, shoot a film on a TV budget within a TV framework of time, and that's what he did with Psycho. You know. Because he had his crew from his TV show, you know, so this is where probably Lucas and Spielberg kind of learned that whole lesson is you get a TV show and you get a crew, you know, especially in Lucas's situation, and we'll just pull them over to do the film because they're already used to working under really tight deadlines, so we know they could pull it off. And so that's what Hitchcock did with Psycho. And so there's a lot of really interesting things that he tried, and they worked, you know. I mean, I have never seen the film, but I saw a picture, and it was an early Hitchcock film, which in the old days in black and white, the bad guys always had a mustache.
Right.
And so
and often they were mortgage lenders.
Right. There was a scene where this bad guy was standing in the middle of a room near a wrought iron light. And the wrought iron light, when another light hit it, a film light, it would cast a shadow on this guy's lip that looked like a mustache. And he stood there for a minute, and then he walked away. And it was kind of a hint like, this guy's bad, but he looks good because he doesn't have a mustache. So, I mean, that's what's really incredible. Long before Lost, there was this way of watching a film with layers and with themes that you saw that really were deeper than just, you know, oh my gosh, this woman was killed in a shower, you know, but there's much more to it than that.
Hey, I want to take you down a weird path for a second. You mentioned Lost there.
Right.
And when we were talking about the filling in the blanks and the imagery, is, you know, there's people out there who are just massive fans of that TV show, to the extent where they go out and they travel over to the Hawaiian Islands to go visit the set, and there's tours and stuff. And
right.
I know that some folks we know, Chris and Courtney Mock, are fans of Star Wars, and they've went out to Tunisia and Norway to see sets where Star Wars episodes have been filmed. Now, don't you have a story relating to Vertigo, Jeff?
I think so. And this is really a testament to my wonderful, wonderful wife, is that she is up for a lot of my chicanery. And so one of them was...
You're quite a pair.
Yeah, we're coming back from a vacation in Northern California, and it just so happens I was doing some studying and reading about Vertigo, and all of a sudden I saw Mission San Juan Batista, the sign, and I went, hey, they filmed Vertigo there. She goes, get off, go see it. I want to go see it too.
Let's go, yeah.
So, you know, we followed the signs and you know, we got out and looked, and the horses were there, the fake horses that they had in the
barn, the livery stable, yeah.
The livery stable there, and then
the carriages and things they sat in, yeah.
Yep, and the church was there. We did not go in the church because the tower was destroyed in an earthquake.
Mm.
And so the tower that you see was a matte painting that was put in the film.
Wow.
But we were walking up and down the little hallway that they that Kim Novak ran up and then ran in the door. But it was still really kind of a magical trek, if you will, kind of back in time because, you know, I mean, we watched the movie and stuff, and of course they didn't say, you know, Mission San Juan Batista. Of course you know these from Vertigo, but, you know, other things have happened here too. You know, they didn't, it wasn't that way at all. It was very, you know, just a historical thing about the mission. But it was still interesting in how, in a strange way, you think, because when you watch the movie, they drive from... you know,
San
a place, San Francisco to the Redwood Forest where they look at tree rings and stuff like that. And then they drive over to San Juan Batista. But from San Juan Batista to San Francisco, it isn't just around the block.
It's a bit of a drive.
So, I mean, you know, it's just funny how you films just, you take a lot of stuff for granted. You know, you run around and, you know, like, it's just, it's really interesting that you think it's not that far, but actually it is, so.
Sweetie, did you have any other impressions of San Batista that Jeff hasn't shared yet?
Actually, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, you go places and you see a set and you go, wow, this doesn't look really, what angle did they shoot it from? Because I kind of sort of recognize this piece here, but not that over there. What? And honestly, when we went to San Juan Batista, I hadn't seen the movie. So I was kind of going off of, okay, yeah, sure, sounds good to me. I'm assuming this is right. But we took pictures, and I made mental notes of what it looked like because I wanted to see if it, you know, how it looked in the film, how different it was. And it was surprising that they haven't changed it at all, like at all, since the movie was made. And who knows whether they changed anything. I don't think they changed anything from the way the original little town was or little, you know, area where the mission is when they made the movie in the first place. So it really is very much a historic, the whole place is like a museum. And it's really, really kind of cool. And, you know, I expected it to be smaller than what it looked like. No, it's pretty much what you see in the movie is what you get. And they have little signs here and there, especially in the livery stable. This is the horse where Kim Novak and Jimmy Stewart sat and blah, blah, blah. And this is the carriage they used. And here's where she ran up this hallway. And, you know, they have little plackets here and there that talk about it. But it's really, they've really left it untouched. And it's really a cool place to go. And I really enjoyed the you know, the visit. And then I watched the movie afterwards and went, oh, my gosh, that's exactly, we were there. We were standing right there. It's kind of a funny way to, wow, oh, my gosh, it's really cool. You know, and there is something really special about it. And, you know, I do get a huge kick out of being someplace and go, this is in this movie. Oh, my gosh, these people stood right here. These people did this, and this is what happened here. And, you know, I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it a lot.
Well, that's a neat story.
Why, thank you.
I think what I want to kind of end up with is talking about how Hitchcock would make psychoses and sadness interesting, suspenseful, or comedic. And, I mean, what's so interesting about a guy who, you know, talks for his dead mom and carries her, you know, long, rotted corpse that he's, you know, sewn together? I mean, how suspenseful is that? Is that weird or is that suspenseful? You know, a cop who dresses up a stranger to look like a lover who is dead.
But yeah, and the funny thing is that she was not. It wasn't her. He put her back the way. And you're talking about Vertigo. He put
right.
her back the way she was when he first met her. They were never lovers. He just fell
okay.
in love with her, and then when she went back, instead
right,
of
right.
play acting, he put her, you know. So, yeah, I mean, but that in itself is kind of twisted because, I mean, on the one hand, you could kind of almost understand it. If he had lost Madeline, if he really knew the real Madeline, and if she really had died and they had been lovers, and then he meets, you know, Judy and he makes her dress up like Madeline, then that'd be a little bit more bizarre. But it added another layer of it that made it even that much slightly more twisted where – it was Judy all along, but he can't separate it in his head that Judy is Matt, that he never met Madeline. He thinks he met Madeline, and he didn't. He met Judy pretending to be Madeline.
Right.
So it was kind of it just added that little twist at the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's so confusing.
Is it psycho? I mean, or is it crazy or whatever? I think it's a little bit, you know, but I mean, He had a little trouble to begin with because, I mean, his vertigo was so bad that he had to quit the police force.
Right.
Maybe that's the whole thing.
And that was guilt. Well, but that was the guilt.
He was off balance, vertigo.
Felt. You know, it was the guilt that he felt for having, you know, for the poor, you know, cop that was running around and he died. You know what I mean? I think that was, I think there was there's a lot of subtext going on. So.
Oh, man, well, you really want to end it now, huh? Because there's so much more to go over. We'll have to continue this sometime.
No.
Yeah, we will. We may have to talk about this some more. I just think that in a day that, you know, obviously people have issues, and they're really kind of looked on as outcast and strange, you know, and all this, he made them
bananas.
I mean, well, yeah, but most themes when a writer writes, you know, every good guy has a flaw and that kind of a thing, and normally it's, you know, some little small thing, but in Hitchcock films they always had some type of, you know, deep-seated mental issue. You know, strange to most people. You know, but I mean, even, what was it? Notorious, or no, what was the one, with the three lines? I think it was Notorious with, Ingrid Bergman. And, she was the doctor anyway. So, but
the psychiatrist.
Yes, that's it. That is the one.
Spellbound.
Spellbound.
The movie Spellbound.
Excellent. And Yeah, but there's always some type of doctor strangeness, something going on. I mean, probably to catch a thief, no. But anyway, that's what I think is very interesting about Hitchcock is you learned a lot about him by watching his films, I think. Probably more than people really realize. You know, and it's kind of like a painter. You know, there's probably a lot of Michelangelo and a lot of the paintings that he... I mean, you know, it just kind of goes without saying, but...
Well, and to some extent, kind of like a painting, a painter, there's certain accolades and recognition he didn't get while alive.
Right.
From the Academy Awards. You know, one of his films got an award, but he never got for director.
Mm-hmm. Now, and that's absolutely true. But to kind of end this section, and you know, the bottom line is if you're interested in continuing this, then email me roniezone@gmail.com about, you know, what you'd like to maybe talk about if we do, you know, great directors, Alfred Hitchcock too. You know, give me some ideas. But
I've got one.
Okay.
The leading ladies of his films, you know, the hot tomatoes they throw on there for eye candy.
Are they
hot fondies?
Yeah. You know, how are they different than the way that the female leads are in other movies? A topic, think about, then later discuss.
Yeah. Well, because that in of itself right there is another Hitchcock has several what I would consider neuroses, and that was, you know, his obsession with religious things in his movies, and it's never portrayed in a good light.
Mm-hmm.
And then his other thing was his obsession with blonde women.
Mm-hmm.
Because the majority of his leading ladies were blonde.
Right.
And whether that was whether they were natural or not, they were in his movies.
Well, he did do some of his early films in Germany, in Munich, so maybe he had that whole, I don't know,
Munich thing going on.
Ooh, Jeff said he wanted to end this. I keep it going.
No,
hello there. How are you doing?
Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, how are you, man?
Doing good. Just pop it in to say howdy do.
Yeah, I got your email. Am I in the? Did I get the Hitchcock show going here?
Yes, sir.
You know, I think we invoked your name earlier. We were talking about visiting locations of movies like Jeff's trip to see the scene where Vertigo was shot and people going out to see where the TV series Lost was being shot. And I think
and
I mentioned that some people have gone to Tunisia and Norway because of movies.
Right. And Lord of the Rings, too, is another big one.
Ooh, and
that's
New Zealand?
It's just that... I got to ask you, how many Hitchcock places have you been to, just for Vertigo?
Just San Juan Bautista, yeah.
How was the experience there?
It was cool. Colleen was mentioning that they had like little pictures of Kim Novak sitting on the horse, and the courtyard is there. The church is not exactly the way it looked, but because the tower was destroyed. In an earthquake, but
wow, that's pretty cool. So a lot of it was a lot of it's still there then.
Oh yeah, a lot of it's untouched, and
it really looks pretty much like it does in the movie. You think that it's going to be smaller, you think that it's going to be very different, and it looks almost exactly the same. The exception being that you see more modern, you know, vehicles around you, but it really does look the same as it did when they filmed the movie there.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. And you said there's like a lot of photos up of like behind the scenes and that sort of thing?
Not a whole bunch.
They're a handful.
But they do acknowledge that it was filmed there.
Yes. And they will say, you know, they had the carriage with the big gray horse, and they have a little placard explaining, you know, this is the horse, this is the carriage and horse where Kim Novak's character came and sat, and you know, and they have a picture of what's going, you know, what the scene they're referring to. So it's really kind of it's cool that they, you know, acknowledge that information.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's very cool. I did a Sopranos Sopranos tour in New York City, actually. It was another site that I had visited, you know, and that was all right. I mean, it's not very legendary, you know, so there wasn't like this big impact of being there, you know, but it was fun.
You know, that's interesting. When I was shooting in the producers, one of the guys that was an extra with me, actually, they had rented out his house for an episode of The Sopranos where they're shooting in the neighborhood in and around his house. I wonder if that was on the tour.
Yeah, a lot of those houses in The Sopranos, I know they've rented out, you know, which is pretty interesting.
I wonder if you open the freezer if it's full of cannoli.
Yeah. I know it was funny when we were on the tour bus, he said we can't go see The Sopranos house because it's like this very elite, prestigious neighborhood and they don't want like a tour bus of like Sopranos fans walking through their neighborhood, you know?
I could just hear him, you know, telling me, hey, stay off the grass. Hey, forget about it.
Yeah.
Stay off the grass.
<That's>, and they did serve cannolis on the bus ride. That was pretty crazy.
Of course they did.
Well, so, Chris, do you have any favorite Hitchcock movies?
You know, it's kind of funny because I am a Hitchcock fan, like my wife is a Star Wars fan.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah, my wife is a Hitchcock buff. I'm not really very, very familiar with a lot of his films. I mean, I know who he is, I know what he's done, but I can't say I have a favorite film. One of my wife's favorite film is Vertigo. And help me out here. What's the other one? North by Southwest?
North by Northwest?
Yeah, now I feel like a Star Wars fan calling into a Star Trek podcast. But I know
okay.
You guys are all about the humor, so
that is true.
I figured I would, help support the cause there.
Well,
get some laughs going.
Being a filmmaker...
You know, one thing I like about Hitchcock is that it's all about, it kind of goes to that mentality that Steven Spielberg probably learned from Hitchcock when he filmed Jaws. The less you see, the more you're terrified, you know?
Amen.
He didn't really
yeah.
just show all this gore and all this, you know, a lot of the things you kind of like had to think about it, which is pretty much worse than actually seeing it, you know?
You hit on an excellent point because in Psycho, you don't actually see Norman Bates killing Janet Leigh. You don't see the killing. What you see is the shadow of a knife swinging down on a curtain. You see blood, quote-unquote, running in the shower, and that's what you see.
I could just see it. Norman writing his bestseller, If I Did It.
Oh, boy.
But think about it. How many people absolutely have an unnatural fear of showers.
Right.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
Because of that scene.
Pigpen from Charlie Brown.
You don't see. In fact, I can't think of any Hitchcock movie that I've ever seen where you actually see somebody being killed in any kind of gory manner, and yet you know. I mean, Rear Window, the killer killed his wife and dismembered her body, but you never see any of that.
And I think that's the cool thing about it, you know. I mean, that's one of the coolest things about it for sure, you know, his technique of telling a story.
Well, it plays on your psyche far more than actual visuals ever would. Because when you see something happen, you kind of can process it in your head. But when you have to leave it up to your own imagination, you're sitting there going, well, how would that really look? And you start thinking of multiple ways, and you're like, oh, my, and you freak yourself out.
Hey, that's
yeah,
a good point.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're not stuck with just the one interpretation that they get when they shoot it, but you run through five or six in your mind. Each of us is going through a whole bunch of different ones, and each one, well, maybe, no, ow, oh, that would, oh, that'd be messy. Oh, let's
yeah.
do that.
Yeah. Yeah,
everybody could almost have their own vision of how these things happen, you know?
Imagine, now that would be interesting.
It's almost like those, I don't know if you guys remember those old Choose Your Own Adventure books, you
love
know?
Yeah.
kind of fill in the blank as you kind of, you know, wish to do, if you will, you know?
Exactly. Well, you know what I think, too, is important is that we've kind of all just kind of slightly in a roundabout way touched on the whole beauty of Hitchcock. It really wasn't about the actual killing itself or the crime itself. It was about the impact on the people involved and around and near and who accidentally or whatever got impacted by it. That was what it was about. The stories were never really about the actual crime itself. I mean, that was part of it and that was key, but it was the stories of the impact to everybody else, how everybody kind of interacted with that is what I think the, you know, basic gist of his movies were about.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll agree to that for sure.
Yeah, I mean, The Man Who Knew Too Much. I mean, boom.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I'm involved. Crap.
Well,
I don't know if you guys know, but Alfred Hitchcock's daughter comes to a small suburb in Chicago. It's called Woodridge, Illinois. And oddly enough, it's where we're having our Force Among Us red carpet event. And it's called the Hollywood Boulevard Theater. And it's a very cool theater that's, like, independently owned, you know, by a family, which is very, very rare nowadays. But they have this thing called the Hitchcock Festival. And his daughter comes out for the weekend, and she, you know, does a talk and does a signing and introduces these films, and they put like four Hitchcock films on the screen each day, like Saturday and Sunday, and all the Hitchcock fans just go and chill out, and it's like a movie marathon. But they have his daughter that's kind of part of this event. She's like the host, and I tried to make it out last October. It happens in October, and I just something came up where we couldn't go, but it happens annually. So I don't know if you guys knew about that.
I didn't know, but I would love to come see it.
It would probably be worth making the trip from, you know, California or wherever you guys are coming from, you know?
Yeah. Oh.
Sounds pretty cool. Vertigo was one of the movies that they had played on the screen, you know, back not about 6 months ago, you know.
Oh, my gosh. You know, and you mentioned you're not the fan that your wife is. I highly recommend. I was not a Hitchcock fan either because ever since I'd been, you know, a small child and had heard the stories of Psycho and what Psycho was about, you know, scary. I refused to watch Hitchcock movies because I thought they were all like Psycho. And my grandmother actually showed me North by Northwest, which was really good. And I was kind of like, okay, if there are more like this, then I would probably enjoy these. And then when I met Jeff, you know, he's a huge fan and always has been. And he introduced me to Vertigo, Rear Window, Rope, The Man Who Knew Too Much. And I went, To Catch a Thief. I immediately fell in love with Hitchcock movies because of those movies and because he kind of pointed out, see what he's doing right there? This is called a God's eye view, or this is, you know, a trombone shot, or, you know, and just explained how, you know, so the mechanics of how these movies were made fascinated me, and the stories behind them, and, you know, notice how, you know, she's playing a person who's supposed to be dead, and there's a green aura around her. Every time you see her, she's always in green. Green's the color of death. You know, I'm like, oh, my gosh. I mean, opened up my eyes to a whole new world of, you know, movie making and really got me engrossed in the movies. And so now I absolutely, they're some of my favorite movies, and I'll sit and watch them, you know, I have no problem watching hundreds and hundreds of times over and over again.
Right.
I encourage you, if you're going to watch any of the Hitchcock movies, the first three I would definitely watch would be Rear Window, Vertigo, and The Man Who Knew Too Much. Those three by far are some of the best movies he's ever made. So that's my first recommendation.
Yeah, I've seen the first one you mentioned. I've seen that, but it's probably been about 5 years. You know, that was the trade off. My wife would watch some of Star Wars, and I would have to watch all of the Hitchcock movie. You know? No, it's one of those things, you know, where, you know, we introduce each other to the films, if you will. You know.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, Jeff actually, I mean, I'd seen Star Wars movies, but he gave me a little bit more of an appreciation for them than I originally had. So, you know, you might find yourself a big fan of Hitchcock movies after all.
I'd have to say I have a deep appreciation for Hitchcock and his films. It's just, I don't know why I haven't really, I probably haven't watched as many, you know, as I could have. I I definitely like I like all of what I've seen, you know, but I know he's got a lot of movies, you know.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
This really is an intervention, and we don't have your wife on another line. you're okay. You know, you could stay a partial fan. It's okay.
No, it's one of those. I don't know if it's you know, I was gonna say a generational thing, but my wife is only 5 years older than I am. You know, I think maybe in Hall, I think I started watching some of the 70s and early 80s horror movies when I was probably about 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a lot of the horror movies way too young, you know. But, of course, Hitchcock is more suspense, I believe, than horror, you know. And maybe even some mystery. But I think, you know, when I was younger and growing up, I can't say I grew up on Hitchcock films, you know. I don't know if I tried to stay away from it, but I was kind of traumatized. I was one of those kids that's been traumatized from the garbage I've watched on TV, you know.
Okay.
Growing up.
Silver Spoons did that to me.
What did that to you?
Silver Spoons.
Well,
family ties.
Oh.
Yeah.
Roseanne, you know, those.
Oh, no.
TV sitcom. No. My wife's a huge fan of, like, the old 80s TV sitcoms, too, and it's like...
Yeah, I wonder who else is like that. Oh, my wife.
Hey, I can't help it. You know what? It reminds me of my...
We got different strokes. We got different strokes.
You know what? I was never a fan of that show.
Yeah, she loves shows that reminds her of what it was like before she was married to me, so... Yeah, I'm comforted in that.
No,
See? All right.
It's a throwback to my high school years. That's what it is.
Yep.
Now,
I think everybody has these things. You know, of course, again, Star Wars is one of those things that we go back to, and some people go back to, you know, what's happening now. You know, these 80s sitcoms, you know.
I remember in college, you know, me and a girlfriend, one day we said we're going to exchange, you know, one of our favorite movies. We were going to go to the video store and we were going to rent each one of our favorite movies. And I got 2001, A Space Odyssey. I thought, wow, you know, this is a great movie. It's space. It's quiet. It has these existential meanings to it. And and her favorite movie that she picked out was...
True Beverly Hills.
No. Yeah, I'm sorry. I just forgot the name of it, but it had Tom Cruise in it.
Oh.
And
Risky Business?
What?
Risky Business?
That was it. You know, it was a fun relationship, but it didn't last all that long.
Yeah.
Oh, it was another movie I saw way too young.
Yeah, exactly.
Risky Business.
But it was a profitable relationship.
They weren't strangers on the train, though. Well, not strangers for too long. let's talk about the birds. I'm getting a little droopy-eyed. I really can't believe I scheduled this for 10 o'clock on the East Coast, but I did.
Oh, you're on the East Coast right now.
That's right,
dude.
Ian. Oh, poor baby.
Okay.
Dude, I'm in Florida. Oh,
Are you at Disney Weekends right now?
I will be on Saturday.
You will be on Saturday?
I will be there on Saturday.
That's pretty cool. I was going to make it down there, but I can't be everywhere this year, you know?
Oh, I know.
But it's a good time. I was there last year. It's a great time. And my family lives right down there as well, and it was too bad. Couldn't make it out there. But you'll have fun, I'm sure.
Yep. Okay, Mr. Boshin, did you have something to add, sir?
Well, I mean, it depends on how late you really want to take this.
Let's keep it going. The tape's rolling.
Okay.
Clear the
fire away, sir.
Well, you know, getting back to the whole idea of Hitchcock and his films, one thing I wanted to ask or get opinions on is underlying behind this whole conversation is the fact that you don't see any directors out there that are as experimental as Hitchcock was. And I wonder what your opinions are as to why that is. I mean, are our filmmakers that idea poor, or is it the studios that won't let them make those kind of movies? Are there not the audiences for those kind of movies?
I mean, this is what I'd say. There's probably a combination of the studios. You know, they want to put the money into the movie and get a lot of money out of it, and they're going to appeal to the widest audience and have the biggest few weeks after it opens. But the other thing is, I don't know, but I suspect that the pre-production work and some of the other costs involved in really going through and writing and crafting it the way that we discussed might be prohibitive as well for their schedules.
Are you saying they're just lazy?
You know, are you a project manager? maybe, or maybe it's that they want it sooner, faster.
I would say that there's films that have, you know, similar techniques and similar storytelling, but, you know, when Hitchcock was, you know, doing his thing, I mean, he was the first, and I think he's definitely a revolutionary, and I think a lot of the people that have done something somewhat similar or have been influenced by him, it's just either been done or it hasn't been mainstream enough, you know?
I would absolutely agree with you. And what I would say, too, is that, I mean, if you think about it, when he was doing what he was doing, they didn't have the technology that we've got today. So they had to be almost be creative to get across what they wanted to get across. Whereas now filmmakers, I think, have so much technology at their fingertips, it's really very, it's very dime a dozen kind of a thing to get, you know, if I want to portray, you know, a ghost, you're not going to do it through, you know, symbolism. You can actually create your own CG ghost.
Yeah, right.
The difference with that, whereas, you know, back then Hitchcock wanted to portray a ghost. Okay, well, then he had to use things like green auras or, you know, colors or, you know, what have you. For example, Vertigo, the dress that Judy wore when she was portraying Madeline, who was supposed to be dead, she was, you know, wearing a gray dress. And everything pointed to her, if you looked at the symbolism, pointed to her being dead. But now they would just create a ghost-like, you know, image of her if they wanted to make her look like a ghost. I mean, I think there's that, too. I don't think a lot of people are terribly interested in these artsy-type films or something that would have a lot of – people want to have the information right up front. It's the microwave society where everything has to be done. Snap, quick, fast, I got to have it now, I can't wait for, you know, or try to figure it out, I don't want to think in my movies, I want to just be entertained kind of a thing. That's just my take.
You are true, that is true, but I want to kind of give my answer to Dave too, is that there are some directors, I think, that still craft films. One is Martin Scorsese, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other is Steven Spielberg, to some extent. When you're talking about a Schindler's List or maybe an artificial intelligence, something like that, in a way, that is a very artfully done film. Like,
yeah.
Scorsese, when he did Casino, when he did Goodfellas, those are well-directed, well-crafted films. Now, And even the themes are there. So I would say that Hitchcock's legacy still is there, but I would say that maybe a Miramax or a smaller studio may greenlight a Hitchcock-like film that would take maybe longer or... What's really incredible to realize is that with a high-def camera and an avid editor in your room, if you have, you know, a set of lights and really incredible actor friends, you can do it yourself. And
yeah,
there's no time in that, and that's what people, you know, have done. So I think it's possible on all different levels, but unfortunately, I think – Scooby-Doo makes money, you know, Charlie's Angels 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So I think it kind of ties back to what Bill was saying, is that it's about the money, but I think that the drive is still there.
One step further too and say that I wouldn't put them in the class of Hitchcock, but I would say people who are directors that I haven't seen much of their work, but I have seen it and I know what they're doing, that would be more what I would say cutting edge or trying to do something different or being a little more creative would be like your Quentin Tarantinos and your Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah, I was definitely going to add in Tarantino.
They're not even in the same boat as Hitchcock, especially not genre, but they do have that same, I think, spirit where they're trying to do something different, something unusual, and not fit into the mainstream. They're doing it purely for the art rather than for the, you know, the big bucks, even though they're making the big bucks.
I mean, for Tarantino, I would have pointed out like Four Rooms or that was it Iron Monkey? I'm sure I got the name wrong, but it was the one that was kind of similar to Crouching Dragon, Hidden Tiger, or whatever.
Oh,
yeah.
Now who on this call saw Four Rooms? Me.
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 Yeah, I saw Four Rooms. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
where's the other person?
is it a first for everybody to see that movie all in one shot like that?
I think so because I mean, just a lot of people go, yeah, I wanted to see that. I just never did though. So okay, you know, I did enjoy a film like a Batman Begins. You know, and I'm not even really talking about story, but as far as how it was crafted and done. And I guess Scorsese would do those kind of whip pans and quick zooms and freeze frame on something that you should notice or something like that. That's why I like Scorsese, because Scorsese to me is very Hitchcock-like in the fact of he will grab that camera and he'll make it do what he wants it to do. And, you know, use a camera in any way possible to get your point across. And that's what I really love about Hitchcock films. And Scorsese is to me probably the closest one in that type of arena. But, you know, we talked about on, you know, other folks, you know, with like a Sin City, that type of thing, or the gentleman that did
Blade Runner,
World of Tomorrow with Angelina Jolie. I mean, he shot a test version of that film in his front room with a green screen. So, I mean, there's a lot of very experimental things that are going on.
Did you see The World of Tomorrow?
Yeah.
Are you talking about Sky Captain, The World of Tomorrow?
Right. That one.
Okay, I was actually going to bring that one up. How funny is that? I was going to ask if you guys didn't know who Kerry Conran was, and he was the director. And what's funny, and you guys will appreciate this, because you all love this, he considers King Kong to be the greatest adventure film of all time, and the rest of his top 10 adventure films are in this order: Stagecoach, Lawrence of Arabia, Lost Horizon, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, Jaws, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Wizard of Oz, Star Wars, and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
Definitely, you know, a big leaning there towards the fantasy.
Yeah. But I think it was that, and what I was going to bring up with him is, I mean, the whole movie was shot on green screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, and if you look at the, just the movie itself and some of the sets, I mean, it's just unbelievable, and everything except for the main characters were computer generated.
Right.
I mean, that's just phenomenal.
Well, yeah. There's films like Memento that have a trick to it, but I would consider that Hitchcock like. It kind of leans too much on the trick, but I do like the idea that it was inventive. And the way it was kind of pulled off. And so I think Memento is kind of a bit like that in a way, and this is a far stretch. Shaun of the Dead is Hitchcock-like.
For the continuous shot at the beginning?
What now?
For the continuous shot in the opening?
Well, that could be, but also because it's a comedic way of looking at something macabre, like zombies. But again, I realize that is a full-blown stretch. I totally understand that. But it's that mindset of, the English, and if you're sitting in a real serious thing, that's the easiest way to start laughing. if you're sitting in church, if you're sitting in a funeral, I mean, your mind is kind of cleared because, you're trying to be, focused, and all of a sudden you start thinking about, what would chairs look like if my legs bent the other way? and it's just that. I mean, it's just, you think of those things, and it's like, why did I think of that? It's supposed to be serious.
I used to think of that stuff when my mom was screaming at me.
Okay.
And then I would just laugh.
Why are you laughing?
Yeah, why are you laughing? Smack, Hey, going back, I think, Martin Scorsese, I think I don't know if he's a good example, because he kind of comes from that. I mean, he's obviously a lot younger than Hitchcock, but I think he
right.
was probably strongly influenced by him,
Right.
I mean, they were, if you look at their resumes, I mean, they were still making movies they were making movies at the same time,
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think, it's kind of like saying, all the music in the 80s was terrible except, something that, U2 and the Rolling Stones did. But they're not really products of the 80s, They're kind of from the school before that, So I think
right.
Martin doesn't – somebody like Martin Scorsese, he's probably not going to use a lot of CGI because he's just not – he's not from that school,
True.
Which is good to have people like that still making films because, again, like you said, it's the way that these people craft the movies, like almost like the good old days,
Yeah.
Where people didn't rely on all that, magic and CGI, where now it's like, you can see anything done,
True.
Well, now it's all about the money, It's all however much money you have or the studio has, the better the ghost will look,
Well, what's really incredible is if a movie like, and we're getting off topic, but I'll come back, promise. If you get a movie like Snakes on a Plane that can generate the buzz it can from MySpace and from the internet, Now coming back, you could make a Hitchcock-like film now and really use the internet to its fullest extent to create a buzz about it. That's what they did with that Blair Witch Project, and all this kind of stuff. So it is possible to do it and to not have to have the backing and the control of a studio. That kind of opens the door for that kind of thing.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of great talent, and I think it's money to make the film. It's the people that are committed to the project, and then it's, can you find an audience? I mean, that's the three parts of it.
I think something like those movies, like Snakes on a Plane and Blair Witch, I don't know. They had a plan, but maybe they didn't know the success that like something like Snakes in a Plane would have. It's just, otherwise every movie could just use that same tool. I think it takes, if you took Sam Jackson out of that film, the movie probably could have flopped, maybe it was this cult following that he had tied in with this marketing campaign, and tied in with the right people and, all and the MySpace thing kind of blowing up at the same time as Snakes, Snakes was coming out and that sort of thing. I don't know if everybody can do what, something like that and Blair Witch had done. Otherwise, it would have been done over and over again,
Right. Well, I had kind of high hopes. To be honest, I am not the movie goer that I was because movies come out so fast anymore, and I don't have the time to see them all. But like Mr. Brooks kind of looked very interesting to me in that type of Hitchcock-like genre. Now, Colleen, did you see The Talented Mr. Ripley?
I did see The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Was that Hitchcock-like at all or no?
You know, I think it was. It had some things that were reminiscent of it, but I wouldn't call it. It was too. I think if Hitchcock had done it, he would have had a little bit more humor in it. It was extremely very dramatic, and while Hitchcock had the drama, he always managed to have some dialogue that was very amusing. And I didn't find this dialogue very amusing in the least. It was very, very, very staunchly dramatic. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think, in a way, Raiders was kind of, I don't know. Raiders was kind of Hitchcockian a little bit, but not so much. I liked his use of camera, but... I don't know. I always thought it was very interesting that Hitchcock would just kind of zoom in on something and just kind of stay there. And, you know, like that doorway in Frenzy, that still just sticks with me. It's because you as the viewer want to run up those stairs or at least see what's going on up there. And it's almost it's like you're tied up, and you can't get away and you can't move. And, you know, so like I said, it's not just writing, but it's also understanding the mind of the viewer so that when you shoot something in a certain way that you know how the audience will react to it and you play them like a violin. And, you know, when you're done, you know, and I don't know if directors think that way about the audience anymore. I don't think so.
I don't believe so either.
I think they tell a story, and I think, you know, they hope that the story emotes the emotion that need to have it come across. But, you know, I think the only thing close enough, and I'm not trying to sell out here, but the only thing that I think comes close is like a Lost. Because there's certain little Hitchcock used to have what's called a MacGuffin, which is something to throw you off the track, and that's what Lost does a lot. It's like look here, look here, look here, and you're looking there, but if you look over to the right, you're going to see the real guy just kind of walk off camera, but you don't notice it at first. It's almost like a Pulp Fiction in the fact of that first set up shot in the diner that you're watching, and then you see the last section where you see kind of over the back of his shoulder that scene and the beginning play out in the background. So then you see the connection between the two, and it's like that kind of a thing. Is the thought process is you have to have everything all really well thought out, and I just, you know, that's why I like Lost, because it's you can watch it over and over and over and see something different. But, you know, there's certain films that just, you know, you can see it once and you go, okay, I've seen it. Great. You know, I don't know. So, okay. Running out of steam, neighbors. Running out of steam here. Okay. Let us end this discussion here. I want to thank everybody for showing up, Mr. Chris Mock, the director and brainchild of The Force Among Us, fantastic documentary film at theforceamongus.com. I want to thank Mr. Dave Boshian for stopping by and for giving us a titillating question that kind of took us into the last section. And, of course, my lovely wife, Saweetie, and my good friend, your buddy, Bill.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Jack B., Tony Carlin, Emily from Ohio. You know, they left early. They must be out of their gourds, but thanks for stopping by.
And you had fun at MGM.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I will, and we're going to do a live remote show from there.
Nice, so nice.
That should be fun and exciting. We're going to interview people in Slave Leia costumes and people that are not in Slave Leia costumes.
Are you going to be there for the transition?
No.
Oh. Can you define not in costume, Jeff?
Well, yeah. Yeah, there...
Trouble,
no, no, I can't, actually.
You'll have to look on the Flickr page for the photos.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, thanks so much, guys. Have a good evening, and I'm almost into tomorrow. So.
Okay, those of you that...
later.
All right, you guys have a good one.
Thanks.
All right,
take care.
And those of you that are listening that have enjoyed this episode of the Roni Zone Radio, come on back. You can always find it at talk.ronizone.com. Send us email at ronizone@gmail.com so we can let you know about upcoming episodes, about topics you want to hear about. And if you have questions, you can always visit us over at www.ronizone.com for all of our great shows, Ear Giggles, Tatooine TV, and the upcoming, oh, I don't want to give it away too soon. Just come on by.
Ha ha ha.